Blog Talk Radio.
This week's show is sponsored by Audible, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want with Audible.
It's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser.
Y'all ready for this?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Making Sense with Steve Laser, the show that breaks down the top issues in the last week in politics, strips out all the nonsense, and provides you the best analysis in political media. This week, we have two special interviews for you. First, Lee Papa the Rude Pundit returns to talk with me about a number of topics, including the latest manufactured outrage on the healthcare law, and that's healthcare coverage for ex-cons. Then we talk about Christie giving out campaign inducement trinkets made out of the steel from the downed World Trade Center buildings. And Lee also talks with me about the Alex Sink defeat in Florida and whether that portends anything for the 2014 midterm elections. Then we have a special treat. Dr. Rob Habers, Executive Director of the Winston Churchill Memorial and Library at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, joins us to discuss what Winston Churchill's perspective might have been on the current crisis with Russia. At the end, we'll have our trademark weekly hall of fame and shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. If you want to write to me and give me your opinion of any topic I cover, write to makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, and I may just read your opinion on the air. Again, that's makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. My interview with the Rude Pundit starts now. All right, folks. To help me discuss some of the top issues this week, I have Lee Papa here with me. Lee is an associate professor of English at City University of New York's Staten Island campus. Lee is one of the most widely read progressive bloggers under his alter ego, The Rude Pundit, at rudepundit.blogspot.com. He's the author of several books, including The Rude Pundit's Almanac, and is a frequent guest on the Stephanie Miller radio show and also a frequent guest here at Making Sense. Welcome back to the show, Lee.
Oh, thanks a lot, Steve. Glad to be here.
We love to have you here. And, one of the things that made me think of you is I realized that this must be a really sad time of year for you, and I wanted to try to bring you on the show and cheer you up, because I know, Lee, that you go into a deep depression and melancholy once CPAC ends and you can't see all of your favorites all at the same time, right after the other.
No, yeah, you're right. It's really like the end of Christmas for me. Every speech was like another little package to open and go, oh, what's inside this?
I sometimes wonder when these guys, who all expect to try to get elected again, or reelected or reelected for the first time, when they go up there, do they realize that we're listening and we can play this stuff back? I sometimes wonder, do you remember they had that one guy who was making racist comments on The Daily Show? And I forget what the name is of the interviewer, but he said, we can hear you, right? Now, I want to say that at the end of almost every single one of those CPAC speeches. We can hear you. You guys know that, right?
Yeah, but, they love that because the people that they're talking to actually love the idea that what they're saying is pissing us off. And that just gives them more street cred, more primary street cred, I guess.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It's probably not too different from when Newt Gingrich went after the moderator last time around. The moderator says something that, is not favorable for Newt. Newt attacks the moderator, and all of a sudden Newt's a hero. God only knows why that is, but that works in conservative land. I don't know. But anyway, we could talk about... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I do love that at this conservative gathering, it's always the libertarians that kind of take over. I'd like to think it's the libertarians that are the reason why ads for gay escorts go skyrocket in D.C. around the time of CPAC. And that's actually true. I'm not making that up.
Well, I gently am trying to sort of help the whole process that I think is happening, that the Republican Party is sort of moving into the whole libertarian thing. I think they're moving in that direction. I think that's actually going to be a good thing for the country because on a lot of equality issues, I think the libertarians are much better than the Republicans. And they're really not any different on the economic front. So it doesn't hurt anything. And also they're better on on war and things like that. So I encourage that, but it really is kind of funny that Rand Paul wins, and before that his dad Ron Paul wins, but they never get the nomination. It's really kind of an interesting thing that is going on there with the Republican Party. But anyway, we can talk about CPAC all night. I want to talk about, first off, the article that you wrote on your blog titled "Newest Outrage: Obamacare Will Help Some of the Most Helpless." And I think, you know, I started to write a book a couple of years ago called "Manufactured Outrage," and this made me want to continue doing that because it just Republicans can write, they can manufacture outrage over anything, over nothing. And this article that you wrote really drove it home. Tell us a little bit about what that story is about.
Well, what happened was that there was a report put out by the Justice Department that was looking at some of the effects of the Affordable Care Act. And one of the effects of the Affordable Care Act will be that people in prison will be able to get health insurance through the expansion of Medicaid in the states where that's happening. And in fact, there are counties and states that are actively enrolling inmates because, for one thing, it will help them with long-term costs for prisoners when they have to long hospital stays. The insurance will actually pick it up instead of the state having to pick up the cost. And then it provides it for them when they get out. So if you have somebody that has a mental illness, then they can continue with the drugs that they're on. When they leave prison, they only have 30 days worth. So, you know, so I'm all for not having, you know, crazy ex-cons that are sick wandering the streets. But apparently conservatives don't really, you know, don't mind that because now there's been a slow trickle of outrage. I think we're going to see ads with this at some point. But there are some on the right that are getting outraged at the idea of, oh, our tax dollars are going to help the ex-cons or helping people that have committed crimes.
And to that point, you mentioned an article in Forbes magazine, and I want to read one quote from that article. "You can be sure that there are plenty of taxpayers who work hard and play by the rules who are wondering why they should pay more in taxes for this purpose. It's certainly not what they were told when they were paying for when Obamacare was passed." Now, I wonder, did people not think that inmates and ex-cons got health care ever? Did they think that they just, if they got a cut that got infected, that they died, that the institutions would just let them die? What did people think? How are they trying to sell this?
Maybe if they have felony convictions, they not only have to give up their right to vote, they have to give up their right to you know, government-sponsored health care. I don't understand. I understand why this mania in this country, and it really is something that's pretty specific to our country, the continued punishment of people when they leave prison. And, I mean, you know, we could get into the whole prison industrial complex and the for-profit prisons that are driving some of this. But, you know, one of the things that it was reacting to is the fact that because we have so many people in prison, because, you know, by numbers and per capita, the United States far, far outpaces other industrialized countries. There's going to be a significant number, millions of people, that will be eligible for Medicaid, and so it's going to make up to about 35% of the new Medicaid recipients will be people who are had some run-in with the criminal justice system.
Yeah, you know what? Let me put this in perspective for any Republicans who might be listening, okay? Because I do conservative media a lot, and I try to bring conservative arguments to make liberal points. And let me do one of those right here. I have had this discussion with Republicans before, and I tell them this: I don't care if you have somebody convicted of a crime. If you want to keep him in jail for the rest of his life, that doesn't bother me as much as letting him out and not giving him an opportunity, or her, an opportunity to succeed, because what you're going to do is you're going to make somebody else a victim of that person. So if you're going to let them out ever, make sure they have a way to make a living. Make sure that their record doesn't follow them to the point where they can't get hired. And, yeah, give them every opportunity. It's in the interests of all of us, you know. And when I put it that way, usually I get this wide-eyed look from the Republican. You don't hear very much back from them. Otherwise, keep them in jail forever. I know that's not fair. I know that sounds harsh, but it makes more sense than to take somebody who has already committed a crime and put them back on the street without any opportunity, without help. That is a guaranteed prescription for failure. Go ahead.
And that the internal mechanisms within the prison are there to just really f*** people up, you know?
Yeah.
That the amount, first of all, there's overcrowding. There's the over-reliance on solitary confinement, which, you know, thank goodness is finally getting some response now. As we see that this is a kind of torture that we've been putting people, you know, even teenagers through. There are teenagers that are put in solitary confinement for mild infractions. So
I wonder if we have Orange is the New Black to thank for that, by the way. But anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, you know, I got to catch up on that. Side note, it's one of those shows. I'm so far behind right now. I'm actually watching The Wire for the first time.
Wow.
So. Which is kind of cool to watch it and go, wow, I
love
that.
I feel
like
you know,
a little
when
thing
you
just
get to the
me.
Point, I met Marlo in person, by the way. That's one of my big claims to fame right now. But anyway.
Okay. So, but anyway, so we're creating this population and that we're mistreating, we're legislatively and judicially mistreating them, and then we let them on the street and say, okay, now, you know, take all those skills you didn't learn in prison and apply them to the real world.
Yeah, again, prescription for failure. And you know what? Finally, I just want to say this is nothing new, okay? Republicans, you're trying to manufacture out here, outrage here. Inmates have always gotten free food. They've always gotten free lodging, and they've always gotten free medical care. Three hots and a cot, that's the joke that we've always, you know, heard talked about. And once again, this is nothing new. But go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, what the hell? I mean, you know, what were the other outrages this week? We had Paul Ryan talking about, you know, that free school lunches was something that was actually harming kids. I mean,
and he lied about the reference he used, of course. But anyway,
right,
go ahead.
Right. Well, no, but that wasn't the first time. I mean, there was, I think it was Brent Bozell who wrote an article about getting rid of free school lunches because it'll make kids, I don't know. I can't even figure it out. It's like, can't there be something here that is just something we do for society? Is a free sandwich really going to damage the self-esteem of some kid? Or is sitting there starving and not being able to concentrate gonna help that kid to really toughen up and become a successful capitalist?
Well, and the studies are all there. You know, kids do better in school. You have a better outcome for them in general. Guess what? If they're fed. You know, why are we even talking about this? I mean, this is one of the it's such a crazy thing. But anyway, listen, I want to move on to another story real quickly because I want to get your take on this. We've talked about Chris Christie on this show before, you and I together. Now, just when you thought the Chris Christie story couldn't get any worse, any sleazier, it comes out, I don't know if you saw this story, that as an inducement to support him, Chris Christie sent out keepsakes made of the 9/11 World Trade Center building steel to various New Jersey mayors as inducements. Now, I have to say, I'm not joking at all when I say this. This is not even a political thing or partisan thing, I should say, at all. When I heard that, I threw up in my mouth a little bit. I am totally serious. I'm totally disgusted by that. Am I overreacting? Tell me.
Okay. First of all, I don't think you're entirely overreacting. Some of the gifts were the timing is a little weird because to support the story, because some of them were gifted, you know, a couple of years before he got any support from somebody. However, there's enough there to go to think. Were they really just sitting there thinking, okay, what will be something that will show that I appreciate what they did? Let's give them a piece of our national horror. It's one of those things that you want not to be true, but you dread is actually true. And now that we see sort of, we're getting this insight into just how deeply corrupt and manipulative the Christie administration is, how nakedly power-hungry it was, and to try to paint this sort of picture of unity and bipartisanship, that it simply just, it doesn't stretch credulity to say that he did this. And that, to me, is another one of those things that punctures the Christie myth, is that we can read the story and go, yeah, you know what, that does sound like something that motherfucker would do.
It's one of the creepiest things that I've heard in a long time. I can't imagine wanting to get a piece of that as a gift. I can't imagine reacting well to that. It has nothing to do with Republicans, Democrats, or politics. It just seems very creepy. Now, how does Christie and his administration explain this away? Lee, play Republican strategist, or at least consultant to Christie. Come on, I know you're dying to put that mantle on. How would you tell him to explain this? I mean, is there anything he can say?
If it's Christie, he's just going to brush it off. He's just going to brush it off like he does everything. Like he brushed off the hecklers. Did you see what he did with the hecklers yesterday in Mount Laurel?
The veneer of his sort of subdued persona that he's adopted since the crisis came out for his administration is gone, clearly. I mean, he lost it. He's done.
Right, but he also, when people were heckling him and trying to get him to answer questions about the bridge, about Sandy funds, he told them to, you know, you're done, and then he blamed people for not wanting to be bipartisan and try to work things through. He blamed the media for trying to set people on each other when he hasn't had a press yet. He won't take any questions from reporters. He hasn't taken questions from reporters since that January 9th press conference when he said, you know, essentially, I knew nothing. And but you know, it's one of those stories that I think that at this point his silence on it is going to be the best thing he could do, or he'll just do the typical what he's done with it so far, which is dismiss it as absurd, dismiss it as something I would never do, dismiss it in every way possible without ever saying he didn't do it. And it is a crafty thing he does, the way he words things. That is a lawyer when you hear him talk about what he knew and when he knew it. That is a man that knows how to thread that needle between is and is.
But why isn't this forcing his resignation? It's such a disgusting thing. I mean, maybe you don't think it's quite as bad as I think it is. How is he not getting pelted by rotten vegetables everywhere he goes now? I mean, this is for folks who don't know what it's still like, how many years later in New York City, 13 years later, it's still a very serious thing in New York. Almost everybody knows somebody who was here at the time. Almost everybody knows somebody who died. This is an absolutely disgusting and morbid gift to give out. If I was a consultant for the Christie campaign and I heard this, I would say, you know what, I'm tendering my resignation. I can't even think of a way to make this look good for you, Governor. I'm sorry. I'm quitting. I'm going to start, ringing up cashier stuff at McDonald's or driving a truck and whatever, you know, bowling. I don't know. Whatever it is, other than trying to help you with this, because this is way too far.
I don't even get the notion of going around and delivering. I mean, I love this line. This is in one of the New York Times stories about it. This was Bill Baroni, who was at that time deputy executive director of the Port Authority. He later resigned because of Bridgegate. That there was steel distribution. This is what Baroni said. In early September, and I believe that was September 2011 for the 10th anniversary, the lieutenant governor and I traveled around New Jersey and delivered pieces of World Trade Center steel that were part, obviously, of the towers that collapsed. I don't even understand why at the time that just didn't seem just horrifically ghoulish, you know?
Exactly.
Essentially, you're driving around with something that is covered in the ashes and remains of people who were vaporized.
Thank you.
I understand that there's this, you probably know more about this than I do, but the phenomenon of things like groupthink, where people get together in a room and they all convince each other that this is not a bad thing, and whatever, you know, the whole Challenger disaster. No, you know what, it's not really too cold to send up the shuttle. But how is it possible that no one who knew about this said, you know, I'm not so sure this is a good thing?
Right. No, I agree. I mean, I don't understand. I don't understand. First of all, you know, I guess I understand that everybody wants a piece of the holy relics, if I can be sarcastic about it. That's the way it seems to be being handed out. Like, you know, here's some of the bones of Jesus or a splinter from the cross. And but the proximity to it is what makes it whole, makes us all holy. But just this idea that they were, that, I mean, think about that. They're riding around with a trunk full of 9/11 debris, stopping like Santa to deliver a package. And there's just, I mean, what good did it do to do it in that way? Why not, I mean, if you wanted to do something like that, why not do it, I don't know, in over a long period of time? Or I don't know. It's just, it's incredibly ghoulish to me.
I agree. And I think I think he needs to resign. I've said that before, but he's got to go.
Just in the last day or so, they actually changed their policy to giving out 9/11 relics.
Wait a second. Hold on just a second. They just stopped doing this now?
Yeah, there was a... I'm actually looking at a report from the Trenton newspaper saying that yes, they just recently stopped doing it.
Probably
as a result of the report.
All right. Okay. You know what? I don't even want to talk about this anymore. I want to move on.
All right.
No, you can see Alex, the Trenton Times, World Trade Center Steel Awards, put on hold by Port Authority.
Yeah. No. I'm sorry, Lee. I don't even want to talk about it anymore. No. Let's move on. The next topic. I wanted to talk to you about 2014. Alex Sink just lost. We just had one of those special elections leading up to a midterm congressional election. Everyone trips over themselves trying to analyze the race to determine what it portends. Sorry, everybody, for the unclean segue there. But, you know, Lee, what do you think that loss for Alex Sink means for 2014, if anything?
Well, I don't think it means anything. In fact, if you want to, you can actually look at it as... Here, she only lost by a few points in a place that had been that's been solidly Republican for 21 years, and that I think Obama lost by a significant number of points, and so I actually don't read it as anything other than. They came much closer to turning a red district blue than they probably could have hoped to.
You know, I agree. And you know what, sadly, I knew Alex Sink when I lived in Florida. Not well. You know, I met her a few times, talked to her way before she was a candidate, way before even her late husband, Bill McBride, ran. And I have to say she's one of the nicest people I have met. And for those of you who don't know, she's a lady who rose to be president of a bank in a southern state when that's still... was pretty unusual. You know, she's a very talented lady. She would make a great just about anything, congressperson, governor, senator, even president. But, you know, like you said, the race was essentially a tie. 48-46%, and the seat had been Republican for a long time. You know, I think if anything, at worst for Democrats, I think that suggests that we have a tie in the 2014 race right now. I really do.
And if I remember correctly, I could be totally wrong here, but if I remember correctly, some of the early races in 2010 actually broke Democratic, and so those were, and I don't remember them being seen in the same. I mean, of course, everybody tries to read the tea leaves from something like that, but certainly I don't think people were predicting quite the drubbing the Democrats took. Because I think that they didn't see the tide turning quite that hard because there had been early Democratic victory.
Well, at this point, no. No, at this point, no. It wasn't clear, I think, until 2 or 3 months before the election that it was looking really bad for Democrats. But no, at this point, it wasn't clear at all. But you know what I think is going to make the big determination here in 2014 is, I just saw this, the rising approval of the health care reform bill. You know, every time I talk about this with Republicans, they try to say how unpopular it is. A poll that came out 2 days ago by Bloomberg says that 64% of Americans now support it outright or back small changes. And that number has been rising pretty steadily over the last 4 or 5 months. That number, Lee, is a disaster for Republicans, wouldn't you say?
It is when it comes to the Senate. But when it comes to the House, I mean, you know, we've got so many locked-in districts. I don't think it'll have an effect. I mean, you know, you could say the same thing. I mean, I don't understand why everybody's not campaigning on tighter background checks for guns and a hike in the minimum wage, things that over three quarters of Americans say they support. You know, that's what the Democrats went out there and said, hey, here's something all of you want. If you want this, this is, you got to elect me. Why not? But that's because you know, we have to give equal weight to, you know, the 10 people in Montana that vote for Senate.
I think you're exactly right, and
that's why I am.
and I think you might actually see more of that. I mean, look, what do Republicans run on? Let's say it's 64% now and it's rising. Let's say it gets to 70% or 75%. At some point, Republicans are going to realize, wow, this big issue that we plan to use, we can't use it anymore. What do they run then on, if not that? Do they even remember that any other issues exist? Do they have positions on anything else anymore?
Well, they will still run on repeal Obamacare. And what and for them, I mean, isn't one of the lessons of the loss for Alex Sink is that turnout is really, really key. That if such a low number of Democrats turned out, and even with that, she came very close to winning, that's where all the effort needs to be concentrated on, is turnout at a midterm.
I think you hit the nail right on the head. I think her turnout was just about 30% in districts that supported her. I think the turnout in districts that supported her opponent was 50%. And, you know, Democrats, I have to say, love my fellow Democrats. They have to stop with this whole thing about the White House and the presidency meaning everything. It's not all about the presidency. The presidency is very important. You got to turn out every election, guys. I don't know what else to say.
No, you're absolutely right. That was one of the things that killed us in 2010, was that there was no capitalizing on the momentum coming out of 2008 to keep things going through 2010. There was in some way a backing off from that momentum that ended up squelching turnout. And I don't think that momentum has ever been recovered. Even coming out of 2012, it was like, well, who the f*** are we going to vote for? Mitt Romney? No, we're putting Obama back in there.
You know, and I wonder to what extent the polls hurt her, because the polls showed her 2 or 3 points ahead, and I wonder if some Democrats just felt, oh, she's won this, we don't need to come out.
Or conversely, if it energized Republicans to say, you know, oh shit, we can't let her win this.
Yeah. That's very good. That's very true. All right. He is the Rude Pundit, Lee Papa, with a blog at rudepundit.blogspot.com. It is always an amazing pleasure to have you on my show. Thanks a lot very much again, Lee.
Thanks a lot. Always a blast, Steve.
Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want with Audible. Listeners of Making Sense with Steve Lazer can get a free audiobook and 30-day trial membership if they sign up at www.audibletrial.com/lasersense. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. For instance, Inferno, the latest novel by Dan Brown, is available, as is The Cuckoo's Calling by Robert Galbraith. Sign up now at www.audibletrial.com/lasersense.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh and clean herbals and marine notes, florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business makes you sensational.
It is my duty to place before you certain facts about the present position in Europe. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, joining me is Dr. Rob Havers, and he is the Executive Director of the National Churchill Museum and the Chairman of the Churchill Institute at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. Dr. Havers first came to Westminster as a visiting Fulbright Robertson Professor of British History for the 2003-2004 academic year. Previously, he was a senior lecturer and associate professor for the Department of War Studies at the Royal Military Academy in Sandhurst, England for 3 years. From 1997 to 2000, he taught in the Department of International History at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Dr. Havers holds a PhD from Pembroke College of the University of Cambridge and a master's degree in later modern British history from the London School of Economics and Political Science at the University of London. He earned a BA in History and Politics from Queen Mary College at the University of London, and his published works include the books Reassessing the Japanese POW Experience, the Changi POW Camp, 1942-1945, a revised version of his PhD thesis, Cherbourg, 1944, The Falklands Conflict, 20 years on, and The Second World War, Europe, 1939-1943. So Dr. Havers, welcome very much to the show, sir.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Havers, I found in doing some of the research for our talk that I began to regret the very fact of the limitations of human biology, specifically our limited lifespan, because I think it would have been so valuable to have Sir Winston Churchill around today, a man who dealt with first Tsarist Russia, then as it became the Soviet Union, dealt with it again, and who spent a great deal of time dealing with various Russian and Soviet leaders. I think it's fitting to start our discussion of Churchill and how he might perceive our current challenge with Russia and Ukraine, with Churchill's famous speech where he describes Russia as a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. Now, most people know that part of the speech, but many don't know that Churchill immediately follows that with, but perhaps there's a key, and that key is Russian national interest. And I think that's one of the big mysteries for me. I'm trying to understand here what Russia gets out of its invasion of Crimea that it did not have before it, without international rancor and condemnation. How do you and how might Sir Winston Churchill analyze that part of the crisis?
Well, you're absolutely right. That I just read a bit of a blog today trying to sort of illuminate some of this current international crisis. And, of course, that great quotation, Churchill is full of fantastic epithets and comments, and there's almost one for every occasion. But that riddle wrapped inside an enigma piece is a most apposite one, and I think you're right. Russian national interest is at the heart of this. It's difficult to see what practically, other than it's a moral question, what British or U.S. self-interest is at stake in the Crimea. So I don't know. And what would Winston Churchill make of it? Well, that's a good question. Churchill, of course, operated in a very different world, as you alluded to, a much larger world in many ways. The days of nuclear weapons that can strike any point on the globe hadn't been invented as yet, and Churchill was on the stage, really. They weren't a factor in his time as prime minister or as a senior political leader. What would he have done? It's difficult to say. Certainly when he spoke at Westminster, and of course the Churchill Museum here sits on Westminster's campus, he recognized both the frailty of, or the paucity of will to act against the Soviet Union in 1946, but he also recognized that by standing together with the United States or encouraging a firmer alliance, that was probably one of the best deterrents that the West could offer to Stalin then, and it certainly, to a very large extent, seemed to work, and it led, of course, ultimately to the formation of NATO and the firm division of Europe into East and West. So interesting times.
It is, and I think that's a big key to this issue too. That it appears, without a doubt, that Russia, that Europe and the United States are acting together and are firm and resolute. I think that is a very important thing in this crisis. But what one of the things, and I want to get your historical perspective on this, one of the things that Russians have been pushing as part of their attempt to gobble up Crimea is the idea that Crimea is ethnically Russian and historically Russian. And they say that the only reason that Crimea is part of Ukraine is because of Khrushchev's 1954 decree that transferred Crimea to Ukraine from Russia. But if we're going to look at history and take the history of the region into account, don't we also have to take into account Stalin's 1944 forcible deportation, some term it ethnic cleansing, of the Crimean Tartars to Uzbekistan, without which Tartars and not Russians would be the ethnic majority in the Crimea?
No, that's all very true, and it's Stalin, as you know, and I'm sure your listeners know, was no stranger to ethnic cleansing and to deportations of large minority populaces of the Soviet Union. The Volga Germans were moved out, to name many others. It's quite curious, though, to look back and see Russia annexed or took over the Crimea in 1780-something. So that's quite a long time for this sort of cultural Russianization of that part of the world to have been in effect. It's almost as long as the United States has been an independent country. So Russia certainly has some claim to the Crimea. What's interesting, of course, too, is that many of the people expelled, the Tartars, in 1944 are starting to come back.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate that I think we in the United States, European history isn't so much emphasized for us. You know, one of the things as I went back through it, I realized that, wow, the UK and France actually fought Russia over Crimea back in 1853, three-year war, the Crimean War. And just to read about how Russian designs on this history, you talked about back to the 1700s, but in the 1800s, they were expanding south. Britain and France had to stop them. But musings over history aside, I want to go more into what the West is doing and should do to respond to this crisis. I get the feeling that if he were watching, that Sir Winston Churchill would be a little bit unhappy with the level of response from the West. What do you think he would be thinking about what we're doing and what President Obama is doing and what the leaders of Europe are doing to respond to this crisis?
Well, it's always difficult, of course, to think what would a historical figure do in contemporary times. Churchill's life is so long that you can almost find an episode within it to suit any argument. In 1940, of course, when he is faced with the threat of a German invasion, he sees no alternative other than to fight, even though that defies any kind of logic or any kind of assessment of possible victory or strength. What would he do now? I don't know. I think he would look to see how willing and how able are the people to the West to stand up to this aggression, and how significant and how threatening is this aggression. Is this a replay of the 1930s when giving in to Hitler, when it seemed reasonable, merely encouraged him to take more territory and more land and led eventually to the Second World War? Well, I don't know. So it's difficult to say what Churchill would do today. It's difficult to say what the right course of action is to do today. Certainly, though, the lessons of history would seem to suggest that you give in to strongmen and dictators at your peril. How you oppose them, though, is the trickier piece. And certainly there's been a lot of threats of sanctions, economic sanctions, and all the rest of it, but I cannot think that anyone is thinking a military option is an option. But
I agree.
But I don't know.
Well, last week I played a clip of Zbigniew Brzezinski where he claims that part of the reason for the Russian invasion of Crimea is a desire on the part of Putin. He said such things. Who knows whether he was being honest about it? But he says that the loss of the Soviet Union was one of the worst calamities of the 20th century, and that Zbigniew has the impression that he wants to recreate, land-wise at least, the old Soviet Empire, and that if he can get Ukraine, he can have a crack at that undertaking. If, in fact, we could divine that is Putin's ultimate goal, I don't think a military option is a reasonable one that could lead to all kinds of horrible things, a third world war, nuclear war, but is there an economic option that you think that the U.S. and the West should be considering? I've gone so far as to suggest a full economic embargo of Russia, and I know that there's a lot of challenges with that. Do you think something like that is something that the West should be considering?
I think that would probably be as it sounds when you're talking about men like Winston Churchill, and it seems a terribly ineffective option. But in a globalized economy that is far more wound tightly together than any before, a complete economic embargo is probably as strong as you can get. So that possibly is an option. I too saw the Brzezinski comments about recreating the old Soviet Empire. I'm not sure I would go that far, but there is always a curious strand of continuity in Russian and Soviet history, and that if you look back over the hundreds of years, Russia has always looked to secure its western borders, either through force or through the imposition and maintenance of puppet regimes. You saw that in the 17th century, 18th century, when Prussia and Russia divided Poland, and so they had this sort of buffer state between them. And then you saw that with the Soviet Union imposing its will on its satellites in the East, Poland and Czechoslovakia, that sort of thing, creating a cordon sanitaire between Mother Russia and the West, from which direction the most devastating invasions in Russian history have occurred. Napoleon, of course, the Germans twice. Now, is that more realistic than recreating the Soviet Empire? That was what jumped into my mind when I thought about what Putin was trying to do, make sure that Russia, Mother Russia, is not hard on the border with a free, economically and politically liberal Europe that has extended so far from the west to the east that it's actually on the border, and you have Ukraine in the middle. That would be far more amenable. But also, I think Putin has a good sense of history, and he knows what appeals to the Russian people, and I think he's acting in that kind of vein, as many leaders do. So he knows that they expect him to do certain things and behave in a certain kind of way, and it's no coincidence that we've seen all these wonderful sort of propaganda clips of him riding bareback on horses and shooting various automatic weapons. He's acting a role, and it is one that appeals to a great a tranche of the Russian population, I think. So, and I think you can see this activity at the moment is in line with that. Quite how far he's prepared to go, I just don't know. I guess we will see with the referendum on March 16th, just a couple of days away.
That should tell us a lot. All right, Dr. Rob Habers, thank you so much for spending time with us. He's the executive director of the National Churchill Museum and the chairman of the Churchill Institute at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. Again, thank you very much, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you.
What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond, and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, BADLER.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R. And now it's time for our weekly Hall of Fame and shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. First, our Hall of Fame for making sense. Winning the Hall of Fame this week for making great sense is Jon Stewart, Samantha Bee, and Comedy Channel's The Daily Show. On Wednesday, The Daily Show tackled an issue that is one part health care and another part gender discrimination and war on women. Here is how host Jon Stewart introduced it.
Now, we're here at The Daily Show. As a news organization, we strive to cover the issues of greatest consequence to you, the American people. Health care, the economy, aging, penises. But only rarely do we find a story that encompasses all of these issues at once. Our own Samantha Bee brings you that story.
Then The Daily Show's Samantha Bee picked up and played a few clips of how conservative pundits and politicians have tried to frame this issue.
One of the effects of Obamacare is that insurance companies have to cover women's health care needs, including contraceptives. But not everyone is happy about that.
Why should the taxpayers, why should everybody else have to pay for an individual's sexual choices and decisions?
Women ought to pay for their own birth control.
They are helpless without Uncle Sugar coming in and providing for them a prescription each month for birth control.
In another part of the skit, Ms. Bee talks to now President Elise Hoag, who rightfully points out that women who use birth control pills don't necessarily use them all for birth control, that they also use them to prevent and control conditions like endometriosis and other women's health care problems. Hoag also shows how $1.5 billion per year is spent by Medicare covering Viagra and Cialis, and contrasts that with Republican opposition to coverage of birth control pills for women. Then they talk about another item that Medicare covers.
Standard Medicare has spent $172 million on penis pumps in the last 5 years at $360 a pop. Wait, Medicare funds penis pumps? Yes.
That's right. Medicare provides penis pumps at a cost of $360 a piece, which has never been debated once. Not once, never.
Oh my God, that's incredible. I know, right? This is what we face every day. So for less than a dollar a day, a man can restore the glory of his erection? That's amazing!
Poor Elise Hoag was really a good sport there, and the segment really hammered home, in a funny way, the crazy contradiction and double standard that is the Republican and conservative approach to coverage of sexual-related pills and devices by public and private health care. If Republicans don't like being accused of waging a war on women, they could start to change that perception by ending the double standard in this area. So congratulations to The Daily Show and host Jon Stewart and contributor Samantha Bee for winning our Hall of Fame this week for making great sense. Now we have our Hall of Shame this week for those politicians and prominent individuals who made shameful nonsense.
All aboard!
I.
In third place this week in our Hall of Shame, we have Dave Feliciano, a candidate for the Republican nomination for Senate in South Carolina. There are a lot of issues facing the country right now. We're still in the middle of the long process of digging out from a deep recession. We're at the beginning of the implementation of the new health care law that undoubtedly will need some fixes. We have huge foreign policy challenges in Eastern Europe and the Middle East. And that's just the beginning, right? So there isn't any shortage of issues on which to distinguish yourself if you want to run for office. No one should be finding themselves in a situation where they're at a loss for things to talk about on the campaign trail. That's what I'm trying to say here, folks. Right? You with me? Despite all of that, Dave Feliciano, who is running for the Republican nomination for Senate to try to unseat incumbent Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, didn't talk about any of those things. I guess he couldn't make a compelling argument for his candidacy based on any of those issues. Instead, he holds a press conference this past Thursday in Columbia, South Carolina, and says, quote, "It's about time that South Carolina, hey, we're tired of the ambiguously gay senator from South Carolina. We're ready for a new leader to merge the Republican Party. We're done with this. This is what it's about. All of us coming together and saying, one way or the other, one of us is going to be on that ballot in November. We're tired of the ambiguously gay senator. You know, good thing you said that, Mr. Feliciano. I'm sure all of those people looking for Senate leadership on jobs and healthcare issues are going to feel completely confident and energized by your candidacy now. In a February poll by Winthrop of South Carolina Republican voters, Graham had 45% of the vote, and the next highest voter getter was State Senator Lee Bright at 18%. Mr. Feliciano hadn't yet joined the race, that's why he wasn't listed. I hope the next polls do not indicate that this disgusting tactic has helped Mr. Feliciano become a factor in the race. Dave Feliciano, running to become the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate from South Carolina, is third this week in our Hall of Shame for Worst Nonsense of the Week. In second place for even worse nonsense this week, we have New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. The Rude Pundit and I already talked about this, so I won't belabor the point. I'll just say one more time that giving out a trinket made of the steel from the towers that likely has the dust of the bodies of at least several of the nearly 3,000 who died in those terrorist attacks, and giving them out as inducements to support him, is an act that is unconscionable and wretch-inducing. He should resign, and Governor Christie's time in public service should be subjected to damnatio memoriae. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is runner-up this week in our Hall of Shame for infamous nonsense. But the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week goes to the Putin government in Russia. Now, by the time you hear this broadcast, the Russians will have held their hastily thrown together and illegitimate vote on the Crimean secession from Ukraine. That will be the final nail in the coffin of Russia being considered, in the eyes of many, a rogue state that engaged in a war of conquest. At the same time, Thursday, BuzzFeed reported on an announcement from Russia's General Prosecutor's Office that it was blocking three opposition websites for what it called inciting illegal activity and participating in unsanctioned protests. The websites are ej.ru, granny, G-R-A-N-I.ru, and kasparov.ru, which is run by chess champion and self-exiled opposition figure Garry Kasparov. So the Russians are moving to quash dissent in addition to all the other things that are going on there. There also came news last week of at least one incursion by Russian troops into Ukraine beyond Crimea to attempt to seize a gas plant, and this, of course, raised fears that Russia would invade the eastern Ukraine or perhaps the entire rest of the country. In the space of less than a year, between the anti-gay law and this military invasion of Ukraine and now the suppression of dissent on the internet, Putin and his government have taken Russia from a state with relatively positive reviews around the world, a state and a people full of possibilities, to a state that is an international outlaw and whose name is now synonymous with human rights violations, repression, and aggressive militarism. That's where the government of Russia has taken that country in this short period of time. The Putin government of Russia wins the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week. That's all I have for today's show. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday, March 23rd, and Monday, March 24th at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio, 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Be sure to follow me and the show on Twitter at Stephen Laser, on Facebook at Making Sense with Steve Laser, and on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great weekend.